Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, welcome to another edition of Word in Your Ear. Now, our guest tonight talks about, in the introduction to this fantastic book, which I could not recommend more highly, Roots, Radicals and Rockers. He talks about the dead ground, as he calls it, of British pop culture between the end of the war and the rise of the Beatles. And in this dead ground, various everyday features of post-war life that have proved immune to nostalgia, and he lists them. Conscription, cod liver oil, smog, carbolic soap, polio, I know, Izal medicated toilet paper.
Yes.
And yes, I know. I think you can still get it, actually.
You still get it on Amazon. And, you can.
It'll cost you.
On eBay. eBay.
And the gallows as well. And he adds to this this august list also skiffle music. The great engine of UK rock and roll, because he feels, and quite rightly I think, that it doesn't have the recognition it deserves. So here to set the record straight, in fact the book is subtitled How Skiffle Changed the World, please welcome Billy Bragg.
Thank you all.
So Billy, I mean, there are fantastic moments in this that make points that I'd never actually realised. This is the first music by teenagers for teenagers. Extraordinary things. Why first did you decide to write the book, and when did you decide to write it actually?
It's kind of been coming for a long time. I've been interested in skiffle for a while because it has so many similarities with punk. And as a 19-year-old in 1977. My perspective on punk really helped me looking back at skiffle, because there's so many, obviously the DIY music thing is really obvious, but there were fanzines, you know, there were people writing the names of artists and things on their clothes. It was that perspective, I think, was really welcome. Also, I was doing this rap. We're introducing for a while when I had a band. We were playing Dead Flowers by the Rolling Stones, and I'd doing this rap about how the Brits invented Americana. It was a tongue-in-cheek thing, really, that I started doing to annoy the Americans. But when I did it in the UK, when I mentioned skiffle and Lonnie Donegan, I could audibly hear people in the audience sniggering, and I was like, "This is wrong. This is not right. This deserves more credibility." And the reason why it deserves more credibility is because one of the time I met Lonnie Donegan, the first time, was at the invite of John Peel. And Peel invited me out to dinner with him and Lonnie Donegan, which was great. And I got to meet Donegan. And we got on like a house on fire. We talked about Woody Guthrie. I just made Mermaid Avenue. We talked about skiffle, obviously. We disagreed about politics. No surprise there. But Peel didn't really say anything in the course of the evening. He kind of just sat and sort of nodded and smiled. And it transpired after, when I spoke to my plugger, who also came along, that the reason Peel had invited me was because he was so in awe of Lonnie Donegan that he wanted me there to talk to him so he could listen. And I kind of realised, we're talking about John Peel here, we're not just talking about, you know, some guy off the street. When you think of all the people that Peel has inspired and knows, you know.
Yeah, he told me he was the man who lit the fuse for him, Peel. I was at Peel's house once and he played me Frankie and Johnny by Lonnie Donegan at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he cried throughout the entire
thing. Well, here's the thing, because about 6 months later I was at his house doing the radio show. And, we were on air, but he was playing music, so we weren't actually, our conversation wasn't on air. I said, what was all that shit about Lonnie Donegan, you know, what was all that about? And he went in the back, and he came out with Rock Island Line 10-inch, and his eyes filled with tears. Yeah. And the point about this is, I understood then that something had happened to Peel in the same way it happened to me with The Clash. Something really deep. It wasn't just novelty music. It had really changed his world and in some ways made him who he was. So, you listen to people like Van Morrison talking in the same terms, and you realise there's something going on there that's not really getting the credibility that it should have. So I wanted to write a book that put skiffle into its context in British pop culture, because the skiffle kids really were our first generation of teenagers.
So a couple of important points before we go any further. Is it true you can get Izol toilet paper on?
Yes, you can, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You can. And they're still making it, apparently.
Who would want
in what dark, in what dark corner of the web can you find that?
Just Google it, man. It's there. Yeah. I think people are using it as tracing paper now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, and the second thing is, the question that we always ask people on the Word podcast is describe the music reproduction equipment in your house when you were a child.
It was a reel-to-reel tape machine. My parents realised if they got me a reel-to-reel tape machine, I could tape stuff off the radio. They wouldn't have to buy me no records.
All right.
So I and it was, it weighed, it was like a huge thing it was. And I was 11 years old. And what I did was I sat by the radio, you know, when the charts were on, to record the songs, on Top of the Pops and recording it. But the best thing was that my friends' elder sisters had the brilliant record collections. So, you know, my first big influences were the music that I got on those tapes when I was 11 that really moved me. It was Simon and Garfunkel and Tamla Motown Chartbusters volumes 2, 3, and 4, and 5.
Right.
And that was all the music I had until my little brother came along and they bought him a record player.
Oh, that's nice.
And a record.
Oh.
What was the record, they bought him?
It was Ernie, the fastest man.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a very good
1971.
And my brother was never interested in music. So then I had a record player, and then I got a job, a Saturday job, in a hardware shop, which had a record player in the base, a record shop in the basement. And not only was I able to get cheap records, I was suddenly very popular at school.
Right, right. So you were born when?
At Peak Skiffle, 1957.
Right, 1957.
Peak Skiffle it is.
It is, that's it.
And the story starts with, I mean, the first person that you sort of focus on is Leadbelly.
Leadbelly, yeah. The greatest folk artist America ever produced. And I say that as an acolyte of Woody Guthrie.
And there's a brilliant quote, which everyone thinks it's George Harrison saying, without Leadbelly there'd be no Beatles. But actually what he said was, without Leadbelly there'd be no Lonnie Donegan, without Lonnie Donegan there'd be no Beatles.
Yeah, he said it, unfortunately he said it to Rolling Stone. I'd never heard Lonnie Donegan say it.
So just left him out.
He's cut in the middle of the sentence.
Yeah, just yeah. Too long.
Yeah. Literally. Yeah. Literally.
Who cares? Whatever.
So for those poor benighted souls who don't know anything about Leadbelly, tell us the Leadbelly story.
Leadbelly was born in Louisiana. He was a sharecropper near Shreveport, Louisiana, in the late 19th century. He was a kind of musician very early on, originally playing barrel house piano in joints in Shreveport. He killed a man and had to leave, go to Texas, where he was actually arrested and put into prison for a while. And then he got out of prison again, and then he was involved in an altercation in which he stabbed a white man, and he was nearly lynched as a result of it. But in the end, he ended up in Angola. No, he ended up in, that's in Louisiana. He ended up in
Parchment Farm?
No, not Parchment Farm. The one that's just outside of San Antonio, where Midnight Special was about, what's it called? I'll get it. Sugarland Prison. And while he was there, John A. Lomax and Alan Lomax were coming around recording for the Library of Congress, recording Negro work songs, because they believed that that's people who'd been in prison for 20, 30 years would have older music. And Leadbelly, they actually in the prison, he had a role as a performer in the prison. They used to get him out when dignitaries came and they'd dress him up and he would play songs for them. And so they found this guy who was an incredible fountain of songs. I mean, Leadbelly was just incredible. And when he was paroled, he wrote to John A. Lomax and said, "Mr. Lomax, you know, I'd love to come and work for you." And it just happened that his son, Alan, who was his assistant, helping him to carry this huge recording equipment around. I mean, really, you know, like a fridge freezer kind of size recording equipment. He was ill and couldn't come on another trip, so he got Leadbelly, he hired Leadbelly to come and work with him. And they went to a prison called Cummins Farm in Arizona in 1934, and a group of eight singers led by a guy named Kelly Pace came in from the fields and sang this song, Rock Island Line, as a kind of, almost like a spiritual song, like a eight-part harmony. It definitely wasn't a work song. Lomax put it down as a work song, But there's no way it was ever... You couldn't chop wood. Lebel used to say it was a wood chopping song. You couldn't chop wood that fast. It's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
It was just one of the songs that they sang, you know, about getting the train out of prison. John A. Lomax needed a big machine and a notebook in order to record that song. Lebel heard it twice, and he went away, and he added some more verses, and he made it into his own song, as you can see. Right. And that was his great skill.
Yeah.
He not only could he write songs like Bourgeois Blues, straight out of the hat, stuff like that, but he could also hear a song, recognise it's a really, really good song, and then kind of add to it.
So John Lomax used to take him to his presentation, didn't he? His kind of shows. Because he didn't do normal shows, did he, John Lomax?
No.
Was doing kind of semi-academic presentations.
He went to Harvard. He went back to the northeast, to New England. And hitherto, they'd only had recordings to hear these songs. Now they had Leadbelly.
Yeah.
And Leadbelly came along, and for many of these academics, this would be the first time they'd heard what was referred to at the time as a vernacular singer. In fact, they wrote a book about him. The Lomaxes wrote a book about Leadbelly. It was the first time a vernacular singer, what we call a folk singer, a non-professional singer, had ever been written about.
Yeah.
And Leadbelly, because Mr. Lomax, you know, some of the songs Leadbelly learned, he learned in situ, working in the fields. So he would explain what they did while they were singing these songs. But some of the songs he didn't have a story for, so he made one up.
Right.
And Rock Island Line was one of those songs.
Right.
You know, initially he talks about it as being a wood chopping song, and then he introduced this railroad thing about the railroad guy fooling the train driver, fooling the railroad engineer. In Leadbelly's song, in Leadbelly's version of Rock Island Line, what happens is the signalman tells the train driver to go in the hole. He's a freight train, to go in the hole to let an express train go by. But there's an exemption if you've got livestock for animal welfare reasons. So he says to the train driver says to the signalman, I've got sheep, I've got goats, I've got horses,
chickens,
I've got all livestock.
Yeah,
and he says, okay, you can go on through. And then he rolls on down the line and he shouts back, I fooled you, I've got pig iron. Now, pig iron, I think, is Leadbelly making a pun. You know, it's pig iron, iron, you know. That's the original story. Donegan adds the weird idea of the toll booth in the Lonnie Donegan version. But by doing that, he kind of watermarks his version. So if you ever hear anyone sing Rock Island Line and in the intro they mention a toll booth, they've learned that from Lonnie Donegan. They have not learned it from Leadbelly. And a good example is Johnny Cash's first record for Sun opens with Rock Island Line and he mentions the toll booth. So
well,
just think about that.
Yeah.
Bloke from East Ham records Leadbelly song and influences Johnny Cash. I mean, it's like mind-blowing.
It's fantastic.
And you think about it.
Well, there's more of that to come. But that feeds directly into the next character who you concentrate on, which is Ken Collier. And Ken Collier is the trumpet player, the cornet player of the
Ken Collier is the most influential bloke in British music you ain't never heard of. Ken Collier.
Yeah, that's true.
Because he kind of kickstarts the trad jazz movement. And trad jazz has a bad rap now because for many of us who experienced it, saw it in terms of Acker Bilk and Kenny Jazz and his ball band, where actually the trad jazzers in the late 40s and the early 50s were the absolute hipsters. They were the absolute hipsters. They believed that mainstream jazz, big band jazz, crooner, you know, taffeta dresses, 15 members, all that kind of stuff, that white bread stuff was anathema to them. And that the real jazz, only real jazz, was made in New Orleans at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. But the problem with that was the only way they could hear that music was off of records. None of these bands, these trad jazz bands, ever toured because they were old men now playing in New Orleans in hole-in-the-wall dives to people who were in their 60s and 70s. You know, it was old music.
Yeah. But also there was a musicians' union strike.
There was a musicians' union ban on American bands touring in the UK, which was a reciprocal ban because the Americans wouldn't let British band leaders tour with their musicians in the US unless they took out American citizenship. so they had to. Collier and his mates could only learn from the original recordings. Now, these original recordings were made in the 20s and the early 30s, often with one microphone. So the musicians who were playing on those original records blew very hard. to make sure they got into the grooves. You know, they blew it. So Collier and these young guys in the late 40s, they thought that was how you played trad jazz. So they blew the shit out of their
instruments. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as a result, after about 30 minutes, their lips were so numb they couldn't play.
Yes. Yeah.
So then, in order to not lose their audience, which was in, you know, rooms as same size as this, you know, and the bar was through there, in order to keep people in, they would put down their brass instruments, pick up acoustic guitars and a washboard and the bass from the jazz band, and more or less play Lead Belly's repertoire. And this was what they called the breakdown band. And this was the beginnings, what turned into skiffle. It becomes, from their inability to have any technique to play, to play proper jazz, because there's no way to learn. I mean, you know, Chris Barber learned to play trombone by sitting on the edge of the stage in the Hundred Club and watching Humphrey Littleton's trombone player. And, you know, that was the only way you could learn. So it was that neat. But ultimately, Collier realised he could only get so far with the records, and that these old guys were still playing in New Orleans. So what he did was, the only way he could imagine a working class lad in 1951 getting to America, he never met anybody. I mean, going to America was like going to the moon in those days, not least because the government restricted the amount of money you could take out of the country. Yeah. You can only take £5 with you, and you needed...
And it involved four flights, didn't it?
Yeah, and you needed a permit to go to America as well. So the only way he could think to do that was to join the Merchant Navy. But unfortunately, the Merchant Navy, you get a job and a ship on a taxi rank basis. So you go and ask for work, you get a chit with the name of a boat on, you have to take that, and they have to take you. It's not like, oh, where would you like to go, son? It's like, here's the work, you're on. So he went, first of all, he went to Australia with the £5 poms. Then he went to, I think he went to the Gulf of Aden. He went to the Baltic. It's the fourth trip, the fourth boat, after 18 months, went to Mobile, Alabama. And when he got to Mobile, Alabama, he jumped ship, got himself a tourist visa, and he went to New Orleans, and he found these old guys.
But there's a lovely bit that you mentioned where he's on the boat and he's playing the guitar, and there's various other musicians. There's a guy playing a suitcase with wire brushes.
He takes his trumpet with him on the boat. He takes his trumpet with him, and he's like myself. He's not musically trained. He just plays. He's one of those. It's only when he gets in a professional band later that he realises that he's been changing key and doing all this kind of stuff. But what he's been trying to do, he's been trying to replicate what he heard on the grooves, you know. I did a gig once in Japan, in Osaka. The support act was a guy in a robe wearing a long kind of Arab turban, went down the back. A Japanese guy who sang exactly like Howlin' Wolf. If you close your eyes, it could have been Howlin' Wolf. I went up to him afterwards to say to him, man, that was the most incredible thing I've ever heard. He didn't speak a word of English. He had learned the whole thing phonetically, and that's kind of how Ken learned to play trad jazz.
And also, there's all those... You go into it in great detail. It's fascinating. There's the Dixieland, and there's ragtime, and there's the spasm band, and there's homemade instruments.
They're all basically... What we're talking about is African-American roots music. So you start with ragtime. Really, ragtime is the first pop music. When African-American piano players start to syncopate, that's when pop music starts, when things stop being written down. You know, and that's the beginnings of popular music there, right there. And then that... Jazz kind of, this is a fighting talk in New Orleans, but jazz kind of comes out of that in many ways. But New Orleans is a really important place. In the book, there's a whole chapter about New Orleans jazz, because I thought I've got to get people to understand why trad jazz was so important. And I've come to the conclusion writing this book that New Orleans is the most influential music city in America for British music. Not New York, not Chicago, not Los Angeles, not San Francisco, but New Orleans. Because it's so unlike any other American city. New Orleans is a Caribbean city. It's not an American city. I mean, it was people there spoke a different language from English. They were Roman Catholics. There were already... mixed race people there when it joined the Union, because they'd fled from the slave revolt in Haiti. You know, all the context of New Orleans is completely different. It was when it joined the Union in the Louisiana Purchase, I think it was the third largest city in the United States of America. And to get to the interior of the United States of America in the early 18th century, 19th century, you can only really go up rivers, and the biggest river of all was the Mississippi. So in some ways, everything had to go via New Orleans. Yeah, yeah. So that idea of the culture of New Orleans was much more influential than say, New York. There's no river from New York to Chicago. No, you know, you've got to go across land. But New Orleans, when you know, you could go up that river to the very heart of the United States of America, and everything that was in that heart before the railways came, it was coming down that way. Yeah. So it's like a city. No other city in North America is like New Orleans.
So Ken Collier's in New Orleans.
He is.
Hanging about with musicians and learning what he can. But he starts to write home, doesn't he?
Well, like everyone did in those days. You couldn't afford a phone call. Right. So he wrote to his... He was writing his brother. I mean, he's basically... meeting his heroes. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the equivalent of going to the Cavern and seeing the Beatles. You know, and there they are in front of you. And because he knows all their repertoire from the records, they invite him to get up and play with them. You know, not only does he go to Mount Olympus, but he gets to sit in with the gods. And he's writing home to his brother Bill. His brother Bill is passing these letters to the editor of The Melody Maker, who's carrying this story. I mean, for his readers who were into trash jazz, I mean, it was the most incredible thing. To imagine going to New Orleans, just the idea that you went to New Orleans.
Yeah.
But then to actually play with these guys.
But then he's arrested. Presumably wasn't, you know, if you were one of those musicians in New Orleans, you weren't used to people coming up to you wanting to know
you weren't used
if
to,
so-and-so one, was you still alive.
You weren't used to young people coming up to you?
No.
You know, young African-Americans at the time were into bebop. And modern jazz, you definitely weren't to expect a European.
No.
And so that, though, had problems of its own, because when Collier went to renew his visa, he wasn't able to renew his visa on the day it was due to be renewed, because unfortunately it was the 25th of December. So the office was closed. He went the next day and he was promptly arrested. Now, in those days, if you had overstayed your visa, they put you in a hostel until you could be deported. They arrested Ken and they put him in jail, and they wouldn't let him have any bail. They wouldn't bail him out. It was so unheard of. There was even an article in the New Orleans newspaper. Why is this seaman being held 38 days? People came with money for his bail. His friends in New Orleans, they wouldn't let him out. And although it's never stated, the implication has always been that he was in jail because he'd been playing with African-American musicians.
Right.
Because when they said, we'll let you out on bail, what will you do? He said, I'll go straight back to play with those guys, because this is what I've come here to do.
Yeah. So when he got back to England, he was a hero, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, because he's still writing to his brother. Now he's in jail in Louisiana. Who else has been in jail in Louisiana?
Yeah.
The big fella, Lead Belly. So, you know, when he finally comes back to England in early 1953, he's like the trad jazz Moses. You know, he's kind of like the man. He's been there and he's done it. He's here to tell you how. And his brother, rather cleverly, has talked Chris Barber's trying to put together a trad jazz band. He's talked Chris Barber into letting Ken take over the band. So it's Ken Collier on trumpet and cornet, it's Chris Barber on trombone, Monty Sunshine on clarinet, that's the front line, and you've got Jim Bray on bass, can't remember who's on the drums, but Lonnie Donegan on banjo. This is the key thing.
Yeah.
And in that context, Donegan is in the rhythm section, he's not in the lead section, you're not playing lead banjo in the front line, as I said, is trombone, clarinet and cornet or trumpet. So Donegan's sitting at the back in the banjo rhythm section. But because it's Ken, they continue with this breakdown session business. They continue to, because they're also, what they're trying to do with their audience, they're also trying to educate the audience. They're trying to get the always suspiciously underlit. This is a breakdown session for Ken Collier's band. This is Ken here on acoustic guitar. He was an incredible trumpet player. He kind of sang and played guitar like your drunk uncle. This is Donegan, who at this period in time is the greatest blues singer that Britain has ever produced. And I would say that continues on until the 1960s. This is Chris Barber, who's the trombone player in the band. He doubles up on double bass during the skiffle session. This is the Bill Collier, who's the brother of Ken. He's playing washboard, sitting down. He's also the band's manager. And this guy, shy guy over here, is Alexis Corner. And yeah, and he's playing mandolin there. In this band, and I would argue that in this photograph, which was taken probably in 1952, you have the founding fathers of British rock here, all in this photograph, and equally all five of them. All five of them. Collier for starting the Skiffle Sessions. Alexis for starting the Ealing Club. Donegan, we don't even have to mention about. Chris Barber for bringing over all those amazing African-American musicians in the 1960s and introducing them to British audiences, and of the work that he did in trad jazz. And Bill Collier, because it was Bill Collier who coined the phrase skiffle. So in that photograph, it was only a short time this band was together playing like this.
And Bill Collier used to bring along his 80, sort of 78 records, didn't he? And actually physically play them, because there was no other way, early on, in the early days, before they had the breakdown session.
Yeah,
in the intervals.
So he would play his records, because that's the only way you could find out about this stuff. There's no internet. It wasn't even on the radio. I mean, the BBC had a monopoly on radio at the time. They're not playing trad jazz. You know, and if they are, they're playing it so late at night that none of the kids who are coming to the gig can hear it. Because often these things are happening up in the function room of pubs where they've got a licence for weddings so young people can come in.
And the word skiffle comes from skiffle parties, wasn't it? Is it 1930s? Is that around 1930s expression for raising money?
It's an African-American expression for a rent party. When people were short bit of money at the end of the month, they would organise a party, they'd brew some hooch, they would get some musicians in, predominantly boogie-woogie piano players, barrelhouse piano players, and they would be gambling and they would make some money. But the key thing about this is that a skiffle was an event. It was a thing. It was the equivalent of a knees-up. So if you were in a knees-up band, you weren't playing knees-up music, you were playing music for a knees-up, right? Now, Bill Collier had one of the best jazz collections in the UK, trad jazz records, and he worked in Collett's, one of the main record shops for this type of music. So he saw all the American imports. And there was a record that came out in late 1948 by a guy named Dan Burley, who'd played at these skiffles in the 1920s, and he put together a little band to play that old 20-year-old, old-timey boogie-woogie record. And he called it Dan Burley and his Skiffle Boys. So this name was kind of vaguely sort of current. It was very popular in this country, this record. And this band did a radio session for the BBC for the World Service as the Ken Collier Jazzmen. And they played their jazz songs, and then they reconfigured like this to play skiffle. And the officious geezer from the BBC says, "Hang on a minute, this isn't Ken Collier's Jazzmen. What is this? What is this music they're playing? This isn't trad jazz." So Bill Collier said to the guy, so he had something to write on his form, he said, "This is the Ken Collier Skiffle Group." And in that moment, he changed the meaning of the word from an event to a subgenre of African-American roots music that never existed in the United States of America.
So the term means nothing in America nowadays.
There never was a skiffle band in America.
No, okay.
It never happened. No. But the key thing is, why did he do that? One, because it was a hip word. And people who are in the trad jazz movement would recognise the hipness in that. Two, it connected what they were doing directly to African-American culture, which was very important to them. But three, and most importantly of all, if he had said that he and his brother were playing the blues, they would have been laughed out of Dodge. They would have been laughed out of Dodge, because everyone knows only old black guys can play the blues.
Right.
So they had to have something else. And so it's a sleight of hand. It's a sleight of hand, but it worked, you know. It worked because it kind of gave what came next. I mean, you know, punk as a term wasn't originally about the Sex Pistols. It was originally about garage bands in America late 60s. You know, the repurposing of the Kingsmen is not an unknown thing.
Yeah, yeah. So who were the kind of people who were going along to see and hear these kind of performances round about this time?
Well,
fans, presumably.
Yeah, a lot of students were jazz fans, but a lot of teenagers as well. There's a movie that you can find on YouTube called Mama Don't Allow.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah,
yeah. It's
fantastic.
Not very long. It's quite a short movie. It's about 12 minutes, and it's
dialogue.
No, it's a documentary of the Chris Barber. But basically, what happens is Collier says he wants to sack Lonnie Donegan because he can't stand him. And Barber says, no one can stand Lonnie Donegan. That's not enough reason to sack him. So they have a vote. The band have a vote because they're a collective. And they decide to sack Collier. They throw him out instead. And his brother. They can't stand his brother either. So they throw the two of them out. He's not an easy guy to work with, Collier. He's a purist. Amazing artist, amazing guy, but a purist. And so it becomes the Chris Barber jazz band with Donegan, and Alexis goes with Collier. Anyway, they they're in the process of making their recordings, and this film of their gig is like cinema verite. And it's young people getting ready, and they go to the gig, and when they're playing this song, Mama Don't Allow No Jazz Music Around Here, the trad jazz version, these kids are jiving. They are jiving frantically. There's Teddy boys standing there in the corner looking at it. There's women jiving with each other like whirling dervishes. If you turn the sound down and turn up Rock Around the Clock, you would never believe they're dancing to trad jazz. Mm. But they are. And they're jiving. Part of the reason is because they can't jive in the ballrooms. The main dance centres at the time was ballroom dancing, big bands and ballroom. And ballroom, by its nature, you don't see it on Strictly, but if you've got a room for the ballroom dancers, it's processional.
Yeah.
It goes in a big slow circle like a spiral universe, like a spiral galaxy rather. If you're jiving, you're more or less occupying more or less the same space. So if ballrooms are dancers are waltzing around like this and you're jiving on the spot, it's, you know, it's going to be a pile-up. So they banned.
And they actually had signs saying no jive, no bop, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Not because they didn't like it, but because it was not compatible with the way that the older people were dancing. So that's how they ended up coming to these events, as I say, in the function rooms.
Yeah.
And eventually, Donegan, because he was such a great entertainer, the breakdown sessions became more popular. Something happened. Pete Townsend in the book tells me that he saw Ken Collier's jazz band at Ealing Town Hall in the mid-50s. And his dad was in a big band. His dad was a trombone player in the Squadronaires, Pete's dad. And he said he went to see the band, and suddenly what happened is the banjo player comes from the back of the stage with a guitar and comes and takes control of the gig. And he says, I knew at that moment that this was the future, that I was going to get a guitar, I was going to play this music, and it was going to be goodbye, old man, and that's exactly what happened.
And that's a point you make, which I didn't realise, actually, that Lonnie Donegan was the first person in the British charts to front a record while playing the guitar.
No one
had ever done that.
No. So he comes to the front and takes control with his acoustic guitar, and in that provides the first generation of British teenagers with something that defines them as different from their parents. If you had if you played an acoustic guitar, you were more or less on the cutting edge of popular culture. You were saying to your parents' generation, because previously, if you listened to the radio and you heard people playing guitars, they were always outsiders. They were either singing cowboys, they were old blues guys like Big Bill Brunsey, who came over from time to time, or predominantly they were Calypsonians, because the Windrush generation were very much identified with Calypso. Although it only came from one island, Trinidad, Calypso came to define the Windrush generation, particularly after the West Indies beat England in a test match at the Oval and cricket, lovely cricket come out. And that whole, the BBC used these guys, because also Calypso originally was like rap, it was about current event. You know, they were talking about what was happening that day. So they were using Calypsonians on the telly and on the radio to do sort of like commentary on things like, you know, that was the week that was and stuff like that. So, or earlier versions of that. So you're an outsider. And to see Donegan dressed like this, I think this is really key, because Donegan is doing something in this picture that no other British singer has ever done. He's not wearing a dinner jacket. Right?
That's right.
He's not wearing a dinner jacket. In the 50s, all crooners wore DJ. Jimmy Young was a crooner before he was a record disc jockey. And he had a hit just before Donegan, the soundtrack of a Jimmy Stewart cowboy movie called The Man from Laramie. And on the sleeve of this record, this cowboy song, he's wearing a dinner jacket, you know. The furthest west, he's not from Laramie, he's from Western Supermare. Yeah. So Donegan coming on like this, looking like a roustabout, with his shirt open, playing a guitar, singing about the railroad. I mean, he's, you know, the only thing he could do more would be ride an horse and have a cowboy out on. He's completely a new type of culture, a new type of figure.
Was there also something about his singing style that I think Van Morrison is quoted as saying that Van Morrison showed a way for British people to sing American music?
Donegan. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Donegan's message, his revolutionary message, perhaps the most revolutionary message that was ever imparted to British youth, is twofold. His first part is you don't have to be a trained musician to play music. And the second part is you don't have to be an old black guy to sing the blues. And that was a revolutionary idea. Van Morrison, he was 12 years old. His dad had Leadbelly Records. His dad was a huge African-American jazz and blues collector, off the liners coming over from New York. But Van wanted to play music, but he could only conceive of playing Irish traditional music. And then he heard Donegan singing Rock Island Line. And as he says to me in the book, you know, there was a lot of guys who wanted to be Elvis, but you couldn't be Elvis if you come from Britain. It wasn't physically possible, but you could be Donegan. And I think that's
the Donegan
thing.
Had this odd little musical style that was kind of in between, wasn't it, really?
Well, the key to Donegan's music style is the fact that, and it happens on most of his records, is that he speeds up. He gets faster and faster and faster and faster. Now, everything on the radio was, you know, sort of like Mantovani.
No, that's true.
It was at the time. Mantovani and Lovely, and a bit of, you know, Helen Shapiro singing How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. You know, that, there was only two types of records. There was jazz-tinged ballads for grown-ups, and there was novelty records for kids. Donegan comes out of nowhere with this new type of music. And the fact that it does speed up, even the other big record of 1955, Rock Online, comes out at the end of 1955, Rock Around the Clock, which is another incendiary record which blows people's minds. It's four to the floor all the way through. Yeah. You know, these are very professional guys. Donegan's record and his performance on the record
starts really slow.
It's on the edge. Man, at the end of it, it's almost the trainers run away with him.
Yeah.
And you know, Barber's whooping and hollering in the background. Beryl is, you know, playing the washboard like it's on fire. And, this, you know, we will never be able to go back to that period and be like those kids were. And because the big thing is, I mean, Donegan recorded Rock Island Line on the 13th of July 1954 in the Decca Studios in Broadhurst Gardens, which is in West Hampstead. The key thing about that date is that just 8 days before, rationing had ended. Rationing of food, rationing of clothes. Someone like John Lennon, let's say, was born in 1940. He wasn't, until he was 14 years old, he could go in a sweet shop and buy what he wanted. Those kids had grown up in the shadow of Make, Do and Mend. They had to listen to this boring BBC music and these kids' records played for them. And all of a sudden, this guy turns up and Rock Around the Clock turns up and the BBC won't play it. I think there was an attitude with the Skiffleers that was kind of like, you're going to ration rock and roll. Yeah, you are. We're going to do it ourselves, mate. I'm getting a guitar, and I'm going to play this music, whether you want me to or not, Grandad. And you can stick it if you don't want me to play it. And they're the first generation to do that. Because the thing about Skiffle is not only is it DIY, but it's also self-empowering. It's like, get hold of this. I'm going to do this.
So let's talk about the practicalities of how people started playing this stuff, because it was you equipped yourself by what was in the garden shed, didn't you? What would you need?
Well, basically, you'd need an acoustic guitar, but even that, with an acoustic guitar, you'd only need three chords. Any old three chords, you can play the whole of Donegan's repertoire. You need a washboard. Your mum's probably got, or your granny's got a washboard.
People had a washboard.
You need some thimbles.
Thimbles.
Or an old penny. Just as good. And if you've got a tea chest, turned it upside down, made a hole in the centre, put a bit of twine through.
Put a plank on the back.
Yeah. And a broom pole, stood it on the top, you could get a kind of rudimentary bass sound.
And of course, everybody had a tea chest.
Yeah.
At that time.
Everyone had a washboard, everybody had a tea chest. Yeah, because tea came into the UK loose in these great big cases.
I took a tea chest down to the council tip recently and they looked at me as if I'd taken a rare antique.
You should have took it to an antique shop. They would have bought it off
you. Back in those days, everybody.
I've still got some in my lockup with stuff in. We're still using them as packing cases. Yeah.
But it's such a revolution, isn't it? Because before that, to be a jazz player, you had to be a professional musician.
Yep.
You know, you had to be rich enough to be able to afford a saxophone, whatever it was. You know, you had to be a certain age to have the experience to play that well.
Yeah.
And suddenly his music is really easy to play, and you make the point also that it's free. You know, that it's actually out of copyright. You're playing old folk and old blues. If, even if you record it, you wouldn't really have to pay the kind of the PRS.
What happens in the UK is in 1951 they sell 5,000 acoustic guitars in the UK, and in peak skiffle in 1957 they sell 250,000 acoustic guitars. Now, if you just think one in five of those led to the formation of a skiffle group.
Well, there's a statistic in the book. You said there's 30,000.
Between 30 and 50,000.
Skiffle bands.
When we say that, skiffle groups, we're not talking about them playing professional. We're talking about people who are 12.
Yeah, absolutely.
13.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, when Donegan plays Liverpool in November 1956, George Harrison goes every night. He's 14. No, he's 13. McCartney goes one night, comes home and tells his dad he doesn't want to play trombone anymore, whatever it was, trumpet. He wants to play trumpet, guitar. Yeah. He's 14. We don't know if Lennon goes to see Donegan, but 10 days later, he forms the Quarrymen with him in a lead and Rock Iron Lion. You know, he's singing, Putting on the Style when McCartney turns up to meet him in July of 1957.
Wilton Fate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're this kind of age. They're school kids. In many ways, the skiffle, they call it the skiffle craze because it was a craze. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with what a fidget spinner is. Skiffle was more akin to that than it was to the rise of punk. It was a playground phenomenon. Yeah. A playground phenomenon. And for some reason, it was almost exclusively boys that played it. But young women also played a really absolutely crucial role in this. Because what happens in 1955, which is the year that the Rock Iron Lion comes out at the very, very end of that year, is the first generation of kids born in 1940 leave school. And they're predominantly working-class kids because middle-class kids and upper-class kids tend to go to university where their spending power is deferred. And they go into jobs like training for doctors and lawyers. They don't get the money to spend till they're adults. But these working-class kids leaving school, there's a boom in light industry. They can go and work, particularly the young women, can go and work in light industry and make good money. They've only got to pay their parents' housekeeping. So in 1955, the sales of women's clothing, makeup and record players goes through the roof. It goes through the roof. And suddenly there's this whole new cohort that's never really existed in British cultural history before. It's teenagers. And they've not got their own social space. So what happens, and this is again predominantly young women, they can't go in a pub on their own with their mates because it's not socially acceptable. They don't want to go to the Lion's Corner House in case they see their auntie. The milk bars are for kids, so they start to congregate in the coffee shops, in the cappuccino bars in Soho, which buy a cup of coffee and stay there till 3 a.m. if you want to. And in doing this, it's incredibly sophisticated because at the time, in the mid-50s, popular culture in the UK tended to get its inspiration from New York and from Los Angeles, from music and film there. But these young women in the cappuccino bars were looking to Milan, they were looking to Rome, they were looking to Paris. They were kind of, rather than Marilyn Monroe, they were looking to Gene Seberg. That was that kind of difference. And they're in this... The coffee bars themselves were sophisticated in the sense that they had these brand new Gaggia machines, these bright coffee machines. The place was covered in this brand new technology called Formica. And there was often a guy in the corner quietly playing some either French chanson or a bit of flamenco. So there was already a context for acoustic guitars in this. So when the skiffle boys put their nose around the door and said, "Can we come and play?" And they realised there were all these young women there. It was a match made in heaven, you know? You can impress your mates playing football, but play skiffle, you can impress young girls. Yeah. And in many ways, that's why I do this job. Buster Fowler was shit at football. I was shit at football. What do you think I'm saying? So that was
because there's skiffle and there's folk and there's kind of spasm and the end of jazz. All happening at the same time.
I think if you were 15 in 1957 in Soho and it said skiffle tonight, you would expect to hear music played on guitar. You wouldn't expect just to hear Lonnie Donegan. You would go in and you expect to hear blues, R&B, calypso. maybe some folk music, what we would now refer to as country and western, which they called hillbilly music. Skiffle meant guitar music in its broadest sense. So this is the, I mean, you can see from the wall here, it says skiffle, jazz, folk song, spasm. You know, you could add another three or four things to that.
And snogging as well.
And snogging.
Clearly allowed.
Girls. No petting.
Girls.
So where do the teddy boys fit into all this? Do they?
They tend to be breaking up the skiffle gigs. The teddy boys predate skiffle. They predate Rock Around the Clock as well. Teddy boys are a very interesting phenomenon. In that, they're the first kind of youth cult to define itself against the generation that won the war. Like, you had your uniform, this is our uniform, and we want respect for this uniform. So they're, by 1952, they're already in public consciousness. There's already newspaper articles, taking the mickey out of their style, which was how the mainstream media reacted to youth culture in those
days. Are they the ones who are heading for national service?
Many of them are, and they're trying to get their kicks before they know that when they come out of national service, they're going to get married. So they're doing their best to get their kicks. You know, they're going to go, they might have to go to Korea.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to disappear off. So they are around, and you do see in that jazz club, in that movie, the Mama Don't Allow, there's guys with, you know, leather draped jackets and stuff like that. So they are around, but they're not really into skiffle that much.
Right. So moving on.
Well, you mentioned Johnny Ray in the book, which I thought was absolutely...
Yeah, Johnny Ray is the first kind of modern pop singer. In many ways, he's the antithesis of Frank Sinatra in the fact that he would break down and cry on stage. And he's kind of like the first kind of geek rock and roll star. So he's a bit like Morrissey in that sense, or
but he's fallible, isn't he? I mean, his whole stage act was to come on and go, I'm kind of damaged.
But he didn't only do that. He kind of beat himself up on the stage. I found a review that talked about him banging his head on the piano. And when Elvis came along,
women loved it.
Women absolutely loved him because, you know, if you're not a very confident teenager, or not a very confident teenager's mum, there's no way Frank Sinatra is going to give you a second look. But if there's a bloke on stage crying, you think to yourself, poor thing, I'll put my arm around him.
Man,
there's nothing more powerful than mother love in rock and roll. Let me tell you. I mean, he was once knocked unconscious by his fans after a gig in Glasgow. He made the mistake of going out among them, and they went so mad for him because there'd never been anything like it before. Before, everyone just sat there and listened. When Elvis came, there were loads of letters in the Melody Maker saying he's just ripping off Johnny Ray. What's his second? You know, he can't even sing.
Original.
He can't even sing like Johnny Ray. You know, it's like, and Johnny Ray only wrote two songs. He wrote "Cry" and "The Little Cloud That Cried." You know, you know, the only thing he was going to go after that was he was going to write "Incontinence." Or something like that. Oops, I've weed myself. Heaven knows I'm incontinent now. I mean, it made it
all right for a kind of ordinary people, as you say. They're not the confident, fabulous Frank Sinatra types. It's a new type of singer.
It doesn't.
Which helps skiffle.
It doesn't register so much now. But if you go back and look at the record at the time, the whole screaming thing, it predates Elvis. It's Johnny.
Yeah.
It's Johnny Ray. He kind of flicks the switch.
Yeah.
He's crying, you're crying. It's kind of like, it's, you know, I mean, I know people who went to see Ziggy Stardust, David Bowie, and they said in the audience like that, it was incredibly emotional. You know, they were really in it. And Johnny Ray was the first guy to do that. It was unbelievable, the effect he had.
And you make brilliantly the point that you know, the people getting interested in skiffle, they just don't want to be looking back. You know, the movies that are being made are things like the Dam Busters. Nobody wants to be looking back at the Second World War. You know,
they've grown up with it. They want it. You know, the skiffle kids are using African-American music to build a bridge to the future.
Yeah.
They're trying to escape. That's why all the songs are about trains. Mm. They're trying to get out of town. They've had it. You know, a former skiffle kid told me in the book that it wasn't uncommon to hear skiffle kids say that they felt they had more in common with an African-American sharecropper than they did with their own dad. You know, because they just didn't feel that experience that people had in the war is so different. And it was so I mean, maybe some of you in the room remember and spoke to your parents about the war, but when I was growing up, my parents and my grandparents talked about the war as if it was the old country where they'd lived before, and they were quite fond of it. There were things they did in the war they never ever got to do again, and they talked about it with an affection that was really strange. And down the street where I lived, I kind of knew all what the men down that street had done during the war, because either my old man told me or their sons told me. And that, you know, and that was for someone born in 57. If you'd actually been in 1940 and grown up with it, you know, you can imagine why you might want to distance yourself from that.
And commercial and television happened in 1955. So suddenly because BBC wouldn't touch the Lucy show. They wouldn't touch.
No.
There's suddenly a whole new world, isn't
and it's
there?
It's just brilliant. It's all that stuff.
In 1955, independent television starts in London. And because they don't have the budget of the BBC, they buy in their programmes from America. So it's Singing Cowboys and I Love Lucy.
Which feeds into
the Liberace show, which is very popular with fans of Johnny Ray for other reasons. It does feed in it, because the Cowboys, as I say, very often were singing. And in the middle of 1955, Rosemary by Slim Whitman gets to number one and stays there for so long that it was only beaten by Bryan Adams. I Do Everything I Do For You in the 80s and 90s, whenever it was. And that introduces the acoustic guitar. And on the following that, there's songs like 16 Tons and other kind of Cowboy Man from Laramie. You know, it kind of introduces a kind of period of what they referred to then as hillbilly music. The British press called it hillbilly music, but we would now call it country and western.
Yeah.
And in many ways, Donegan rides in on that as well. It's a kind of mixture of rock around the clock. It's got the word rock in the beginning. And he's there with the open shirt like a cowboy.
Yeah.
And it kind of somehow, because Decca put the record out, Decca put Rock Island Line out in the end of 1955. It was recorded in 1954, and it was on a jazz record. You know, it was on a trad jazz record. It was recorded in the context of Chris Barber's jazz band trying to make an album of new material, but they didn't have enough material.
They wanted to fill the album. Last minute thought, wasn't it?
And amazing. The producer said, you know, you've got to have 10 songs, because there's so much money at stake. It's costing £35 to make this record. And Decca will never get to make another trad jazz record, because they were at the edge. You know, he'd had to convince Decca to let these young rebels, these young Turks, make a record. So Donegan said, well, let's do somebody else's skiffle records. So they think, okay. So they kind of, Donegan saves the session by playing a couple of souped up old blues songs, Rock Iron Line and John Henry. And this is
literally, and it came out the same week as Rock Around the Clock.
No, literally a week after Elvis Presley records That's All Right for Sun Records in Memphis. It's exactly the same deal. A record session that's going nowhere, because Sam Phillips is trying to get Elvis to croon some old country songs. And he says, all right, it's not working. He says, take a break. Elvis starts goofing around with That's All Right. Scotty and Bill join in, goofing around, really, having a laugh. And Sam says, whoa, what are you doing? And I said, we don't know. He says, well, back it up, start it again. Let's record that. And that's how Elvis and Scotty and Bill record. And it's also interesting as well. It's a three-piece, no drums, sped-up old blues song. I would argue that, or I do argue in the book, that rockabilly is the closest that the Americans came to skiffle.
Yes.
Yeah. In the sense that it kind of doesn't have drums. You know, you could argue that Sun Sessions Elvis is a great, great rockabilly band, but I would argue that the rock and roll trio, Johnny Burnett, Dorsey Burnett and Paul Burleson, is the actual greatest rockabilly band that ever existed, and I'll fight anyone who says otherwise. And and so will a load of Teds I know. And they, you know, they were so synonymous with skiffle that when Donegan went on a rock and roll tour in America in 1956, after Rock and Roll was a hit, the rock and roll trio, Johnny Burnett Trio, offered to back him up. And because he was having to play Rock Island with the Pitt Orchestra every theatre they played in, and he never had the music.
Yeah.
So Johnny Burnett said, you know, why don't you let us back you up? And Donegan, being Donegan, said, oh, I couldn't afford that. And Johnny said, no, we're not talking about money, man. We're talking about music. We love what you're doing. So for that short period, rockabilly and skiffle met each other as equals, and maybe even recognised that they you know, they were blood relatives, even though they'd come from completely different sides of the Atlantic.
And Rock Island Land, massive hit in America. I mean,
it was.
You talk about
number
Lee
eight.
Donegan going over there, and at one moment he's on the Perry Como show with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, he was, yeah. He did a skit with Ronald Reagan on the Perry Como show. And after the tour ended, he went back to Memphis with Johnny Burnett, and they hung out in Memphis and went to see Elvis. Elvis wasn't in. I went to Graceland, so Elvis went there.
Well, but you touched them on a few times. I'd like you to talk about it a bit more. Lonnie Donegan has a reputation as being not being an easy person.
That's true.
In what way?
Chris Barber said the problem with Donegan was his hero was Max Miller. And so he was a bit of a cheeky chappy. And other people... someone told me that they used to... his real name is Tony. His real name's not Lonnie. His real name's that. They used to refer to him as Tony fucking Donegan. And so he was a bit of a bit of an handful. In many ways, him and Collier were in a similar kind of way, a bit of a chip on their shoulder. But they're both working class lads who were kind of getting away with it quite a bit.
Right.
So yeah, he did. He was a bit full of himself, but he needed to be. He needed a figure like that who was capable of getting hold of a room by the scruff of the neck and firing it up. It couldn't have been anybody else. It certainly could have been Ken, and lovely bloke though Chris Barber is. It couldn't have been Chris either. And Alexis was kind of wasn't a great musician. He was an amazing focuser of people's attention on R&B. But I mean, Chris Barber said to him one time, you know, all those years in an interview just like this, all those years you played me, I can never really remember your guitar playing at all. And Alexis said, well, Chris, I never had an amp. So, you know, it needed Donegan. So Donegan is the spark.
So when Donegan, you know, ends up selling all these records and headlining big shows and so forth. How do the kind of skillful fraternity feel about him? How do the folk fraternity feel about him?
Well, it's the jazz. It's the trad jazz people that really despise him. They really despise him.
Despise?
Yeah, they despise him because he's successful. And, and
that's classic.
Yeah, he keeps bringing all these bloody kids in. They don't know nothing about Lead Belly. You know, these kids keep coming in. You know, the journalists write about him. You know, why would you buy Lonnie Donegan when you can buy the Lead Belly record?
Yeah.
They don't really understand what's going on, really. But his run of hits is just phenomenal. I mean, he starts recording Woody Guthrie songs, which nobody had done before. Nobody had put Woody Guthrie in the charts. He weirdly tells Melody Maker he's writing the songs with Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie's in hospital with Huntington's disease, can't really hold a guitar anymore. And he's kind of playing the well, don't show me that. That's the first record that Donegan puts out, doesn't have the word skiffle on the sleeve.
And this is my old man's a dustman.
Everything goes on down the hill from there, I'm afraid. But he is absolutely that key character. One of his songs he has a big hit with is a song called Stewball. And Stewball is a song about a race horse that tells its rider how to win a horse race. Now, Donegan learned it off Lead Belly. Lead Belly, he may have learned it off of the Lomaxes because it was the most common song they found when they were recording actually African-American field workers. It was the most common song they found. Lead Belly was a field worker. He may have learned it orally. 100 years before he did that, it was the most popular song on the Eastern Seaboard, United States of America. 100 years before that, it was being sold as a broadside ballad in Georgian London. But the actual event happened at the Curragh of Kildare in Ireland, the actual horse race it's based on. So the question is, in terms of cultural appropriation, who does this song belong to? Because it sure as hell ain't Lead Belly. No disrespect.
No, that's right. That's
and at least Donegan's mum was Irish, so he had half a shout on
Yeah.
You know, so that there was a lot of that going on, you know. But really what Donegan was doing was he was introducing all these kids to African-American roots music. And for that, you know, they were at the time you could go to the library, the American embassy in Grosvenor Square, and there was the US Information Service, which their job was to promote American culture. So you could borrow books, but in the basement, they had the entire collection of the Library of Congress recordings that were made by people like John Lomax, and you could borrow those records. So, you know, it's this sort of Muddy Waters at Parchment Farm and stuff like that. You couldn't buy these records in shops. No one was importing these records, but you could get them there. And Donegan worked out that if you stole a record, they would just order another one. So he used to nick them. They would go in, people would go, and someone tells you in the book, they went to get it, and he said, "Oh, I'm afraid a Mr. Tony Donegan has had it for the last year." He was nicking them, people spit nails about it.
So at the end of the book, you talk about the folk boom happens, you know, the Ramblers and Nancy Whiskey and Freight Train and all that, and that ultimately produces, you know, Bob Dylan and the kind of folk revival.
Yeah.
And then you talk about, you know, the rock and roll explosion, you know, which comes on the back of Skiffle as well.
Yeah.
So Skiffle's kind of over, but there's a brilliant bit. You talk about the connection with the 1959 and Aldermaston March.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people playing Skiffle instruments, and it seems to be that Skiffle and the kind of a whole aesthetic is caught up with a political
Yeah, well, I mean, Skiffle was very anti-commercial. Yeah. I mean, so was Collier. Collier as well. Yeah. Jazz was anti-commercial. So they kind of fit together, and they were quite radical as well. I mean, not only did they get involved in the Aldermaston March, the Daily Telegraph sub-headline for Aldermaston was they skiffled their way to Aldermaston, but they also got involved in something called the Stars Campaign for Interracial Friendship. Following there were race riots in Notting Hill in 1958, where Oswald Mosley and the British Union of Fascists were stirring up racial hatred. Notting Hill at the time was predominantly West Indian immigrants. And there was a race riot over the August bank holiday. The next week, front page Melody Maker, there was an open letter from people like Ken Collier signed it, Donegan signed it, Chris Barber signed it, a load of Skifflers signed it, Tommy Steele signed it, and they set up this thing called the Stars Committee for Interracial Friendship to promote bringing black and white kids together. It was fronted by Cleo Lane and Johnny Dankworth, who were a multiracial couple. And it's kind of like the beginnings of Rock Against Racism. And Skiffle was at the heart of that. You know, the Skifflers were always in support of racial harmony and doing that kind of stuff. So the politics of it come together like they do in punk, you know.
Yeah.
They both kind of come in together.
And we should talk about all the bands. The Beatles, the Stones. I mean, what, you know, the Jimmy Page had a skiffle band, Deep Purple.
Everybody from that generation.
All those big 60s and 70s names.
And this is the key thing. If you go back and listen to the music that was made at the time, it's rather unprepossessing. Apart from Rock Island Line, which is incendiary in its own way, there's a couple of other songs that have hooks. But it's not what happened in the 1950s about Skiffle that is key. It's what happens in the 1960s. Because what Skiffle does is it teaches free chords to every sentient 13-year-old in the United Kingdom. Free chords, you can play all Lead Belly's repertoire, but you can also play all of Chuck Berry's repertoire. So by the time you get to... Well, Buddy Holly's like an electric skiffler, you know. So by the time you get to 59 and 60, where their American peers, who are the same age, who are now sort of 19 and 20, the folk boom happens in America, and they start learning to play guitar, our kids are already in Hamburg. You know, they're that far ahead. So when the Beatles break into the American charts in January 1964, there's a whole cohort of road-hardened bands ready to follow them into the American charts. Between 1964, January, and January 1966, there's a British group at number one in the Billboard charts for 52 weeks out of 104. Every single one of them originated in a skiffle band, except Petula Clark. And she'd been making records since she was 12 years old. She didn't need Lonnie Donegan to tell her how to make records. So she's the exception. And she's a girl. Yeah. As I said, girls, for some reason, I don't know why. Well, I do know why. It's the patriarchy. Didn't really play skiffle. It's these guys. A peak skiffle occurs on the 9th of July 1957 when the fellow on the left meets the fellow on the right when he's playing a skiffle gig in Liverpool. Yeah. And it's a very interesting quote I found from a guy who was set to mind the Beatles when they first got to Hamburg in 1960 by the guy who ran the Star Club. He found this old wrestler guy in Hamburg, and he said he was kind of like their roadie, but it was also like their minder to keep him out of trouble. And when the Beatles broke in America, they sent some radio DJ from America to Hamburg, and they found this guy. And they said to him, what were they like when they first arrived? And he said, He said, the Beatles, they play too much washboard music. The British bands, they think Lonnie Donegan is Elvis Presley. And the implication from that is that the Beatles were still a skiffle band when they got to Hamburg. And when you think about it, they were the front line from the Quarrymen, McCartney, Lennon and George Harrison, with a mate of theirs who played drums, Pete Best, and, you know, the best-looking guy from art school trying to play the bass, Stuart Sutcliffe. So it's actually Hamburg that turns them into the great rock and roll band. Yeah. They're still scraping away.
Because that's what the American sailors want to hear.
Exactly, yeah, you know, and the Germans too. I mean, the Germans can't, yeah. You know, they can't get American bands to come to Germany.
Yeah.
So that's what Horst, what's his name, he comes to the Two Eyes. He's looking for bands that can sound like America. To the Germans, it didn't really matter, as long as it was in English with a slightly American accent.
Yeah.
They just wanted to dance to it.
Yeah. So you were saying before we began that Please Please Me was there.
I would argue that Please Please Me, is the greatest skiffle record ever made.
Okay.
And I'll tell you where the skiffle bit is. It's in the turnarounds between the verses. That is pure skiffle.
All right. Okay.
That is pure skiffle. And I think McCartney, hugely influenced by Buddy Holly. And I think anybody who is playing skiffle, who saw Buddy Holly on Sunday night at the London Palladium in 1958 when he played Peggy Sue, that clip might have even been from that photograph, would have seen electric skiffle. Because the thing about Buddy is all chords, even the solo in Peggy Sue is chords, it's not lead, so he's just playing chords, and it's only three chords as well. And I think anybody who saw that would think, okay, that is the future, I can do that. McCartney said as much, in fact. But I think you've got to see Buddy as having that kind of not only did he play skiffle, but he wrote his own material. And the problem with skiffle was it was only a certain amount of material, because it was all old stuff. You know, when they had these skiffle competitions in the 50s, in the mid-50s, you know, they'd have sort of 20 bands and they would all play Don't You Rock Me Daddy-O over and over and over again, you know. And it was this frustration that led, you know, Lennon and McCartney to start writing their own stuff, you know, just to get out of this, you know. And they wrote, what did they write about? One After 909, a bloody train song.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of the thread of it.
Well, Billy, it's a terrific book.
You're very kind,
and,
David.
It's been rightly acclaimed as such, hasn't it?
It's been many people's book
of the year.
It's been doing well in America. It's been doing very well in America, which is important to me, because I think the Americans don't really... they love the Beatles and the British invasion so much, but they don't really understand the context. To me, context is everything. One of the proudest things... for me about this book is the fact that Rock Island Line gets into the charts in chapter 13 of a 26-chapter book. Because normally when you read about skiffle, it's in the context of the biography of a 60s or 70s rock star. And obviously people have to talk about skiffle. You get two or three pages about it, but they all treat Rock Island Line getting into the charts like a singularity. And, you know, nothing happens just like that. And my own experience during punk rock made me realise that there must have been something before this. And it was the unspeakable thing that no one talks about, trad jazz. Yeah. So, you know, putting my waders on and going into that. I've now come away with nothing but respect for those guys and appreciation for what trad jazz did and how, why these guys in late 40s Britain, teenagers would cleave to African-American culture so strongly, something that was quite alien to them. But yet, this music did something to them that made them want to play and get up and play. And that's how things change in culture.
You've done us all a service. Ladies and gentlemen, Billy Bragg.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.